Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today's Spirit in Action guest is Alice Rothschild. Alice is many things: a woman, a Jew, a doctor, a feminist, a poet, and the author of 6 books, the latest being Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. Rising in the medical ranks when women were almost universally barred from the role of physician, she became an obstetrics gynecology doc, including co-founding the nonprofit Urban Woman and Child Health, Inc. Alice transcends barriers, limits, and conventions, including having written this wide-ranging memoir and commentary on the Times book in poetic format. There is a full uncut version of this interview on northernspiritradio.org. Thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance on today's show. Alice Rothschild joins us today for Spirit in Action via Zoom. Alice, it's wonderful to have you here today for Spirit in Action.
Mark, I'm very happy to be here today, too.
So I had great fun reading the book. I was actually doubtful at the beginning because it's in poem style. I wanted some good hard-hitting feminist literature or something, and it's good hard-hitting feminist poetry instead. Actually, one of my favorites, one of the, I think, persons who most changed my attitudes in the mid-70s, early mid-70s, was Holly Near. Were you a fan?
Yeah, I was a big fan. She was big in Boston.
Yeah, and I still am a fan, although she's really changed what she's doing now, but wonderful. Did you see her video, the movie about her that was about 2 years ago, I think, came out?
I don't think so, but I went to a bunch of Holly Near concerts back in the day, as we say.
Well, I even went and visited her family. I was doing a hitchhiking trip across the U.S. in 77, and so I stopped and visited her family there. It was very fun folks, wonderful folks there. But you're really an Easterner, even though you're a Westerner now. How much trauma was it for you to move west after being in the East all that time?
Well, I am very much an East Coast person. I've lived in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, but I had a pregnant daughter in Seattle, and she said to me, you know, I want you to be part of our kids' lives and our adult lives, and we want you to come. And that was a rather amazing invitation. So, you know, my husband and I, at first, we were like, how could we ever leave the East Coast and our beautiful house and all our friends and all our political activities and all that kind of stuff? So for 2 years, we were bicoastal, which basically meant we lived in an airplane somewhere between Seattle and Boston. And when it became clear that was not a viable existence, we really realized that our hearts were in Seattle because we had a daughter and her husband and a new baby. And that this was an opportunity to have a new stage of life that we were very lucky to have. And our other daughter is on the West Coast as well. So at least we were all in the same time zones. So this was absolutely the right move. Clearly, I miss my friends. I do not miss things like the electronic medical record and other parts of doctoring. And I don't really miss really cold winters. I like snow, but, you know, Seattle is really gorgeous. And I've fallen in love with mountains and hiking. And now I have 2 grandchildren and we take care of them 4 afternoons a week. So they are very much in our lives. And that's a whole chapter that is really a treasure for me.
How much of your work involved pediatrics as opposed to birthing?
I'm a trained obstetrician gynecologist. So basically my primary relationship to pediatrics was when the baby came out. If it was a boy, that was my relationship to boys. And I did circumcision. So there you have it. So it was not a major part of my training. You know, I did a lot of, you know, breastfeeding support, and, you know, it doesn't matter if the baby's a boy or a girl, but pediatrics was something. I worked in a group practice that we set up in the inner city at that point in Boston with some pediatricians, and we always used to say to our patients, we catch them and throw them to the pediatricians. You know, it's like we helped them come out, but then they went to the pediatricians.
You're not the first person who's worked with birthing that I've interviewed. Actually, and this has been going for 19 and a half years now. I've been doing Spirit in Action. And that first year, I interviewed Ina May Gaskin.
Yep.
I guess she's maybe ahead of you in terms of all the birthing things they did at the farm. How much were you side by side or one after the other? Where do your mutual influences intersect?
So as a resident, as an obstetrician, I was fully aware of the farm and, that she had a whole different approach to obstetrics. But coming into obstetrics, I started my residency in 75. And at that point, obstetrics was sort of emerging from the dark ages. There were still leather straps on the tables that women had to scoot over to have a baby on, which that went back to twilight sleep, which was this awful practice that went on for decades of heavily medicating women with a sleep med, a narcotic, and an amnesic. So they were sort of sedated and out of control. So they got strapped down to their beds and then had a forceps delivery because they couldn't push. So I actually saw that kind of birthing at the beginning of my training, much to my dismay, and then was part of what was then called the natural childbirth movement. The idea that birth, first of all, is a normal process. And if you don't interfere with it, most women will do fine. And that the role of the obstetrician is to step in if there's a problem, but not to create problems. So I was, I'm trained in Western medicine. So I was, aware of that whole stream, but I didn't have any direct interaction with it. One of the sort of radical things that my group practice did when we started out was we let people know in the home birth movement that we were available for home birth backup, which was, something that private doctors were not doing. Home birth in Massachusetts was illegal for, lay midwives to be practicing without a license, quote, end quote. But we felt like, first of all, women are doing this and sometimes they get into trouble and they need doctors who are respectful and will take them wherever they're at and help them to have a safe birth. Because, if you have a home birth and everything's fine, it's a fabulous experience. But if everything's not fine, it can be a real catastrophe. So we were the people that people would call, hopefully before the catastrophe, with a very, very prolonged labor or a breech birth or something unexpected. So we were on the edge of that whole scene, but we weren't in it because we were Western trained. But we were constantly questioning the rules. So I can read you a poem that describes what I learned about birth on the first day of my residency, which I think kind of sums it up, if that would be okay. And that's what I was in opposition.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay, it's called Modern Delivery, 1975, Beth Israel Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. What I learned the first week of my residency on the night's obstetrics rotation, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., 6 nights a week. When a woman arrives in labor, get the IV started quickly. Translation: labor is a dangerous, life-threatening, unpredictable process. She could bleed to death, seize, die, or otherwise be endangered. We need to be ready for everything and anything always. Order the enema. If she's not in active labor, wink at the nurse. A triple H. Translation: high, hot, and a hell of a lot. That'll get her going. Order the poodle prep. A weird shave of the lower half of the pubic hair, leaving a tuft at the top. This was supposed to be an improvement over the old practice of a full shave. Translation: pubic hair. Ew, I'm suturing here. When the head is about to crown, but not too soon because you will tie up the delivery room, but not too late because the baby will arrive in the hall with everyone watching and yelling, rush to the delivery room. Get the woman to scoot over from her bed onto a hard, narrow delivery table, which still has leather straps hanging from the sides. Remember twilight sleep? While the lady is having contractions and an intense impulse to push, and the nurse is urging, low, 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 arrange the woman flat on her back, legs dangling in stirrups, a bright surgical light aimed at the area of interest, everyone around her scrubbed, gowned, masked, as if for major heart surgery. Translation: the most important thing at this point is that the OB can see his sort of sterile surgical field and do whatever it is he plans to do. Scrub the lady's bottom with betadine and drape with sterile sheets. Translation: a woman's vagina and vulva are a dirty, hairy, dangerous place, especially for an obstetrician. Cut a generous episiotomy. Translation: a woman's vagina and pelvic floor are pressing on the vulnerable baby's head. Not built quite right for the job. It's a miracle anyone survived birth before we came along and improved everything.
That's a little bit too shocking to think of.
So, I was this impressionable young resident. I come in, I think, this doesn't look right, but it took me a while to understand what the problems were and then to be able to have enough power to challenge them and, to have women delivering in their beds or on all fours or on the floor, however they needed to deliver, and not to do an episiotomy. But it took a while for us there was another woman in the practice with me in my residency that we were both like, what? This doesn't seem right. So, you know, we were the troublemakers in our residency department. But a lot of these things are now more standard in hospitals, or at least in the hospitals I've been to. But again, in hospitals, the birth experience is medicalized. And, you know, I would argue that treating birth as a healthy, normal experience and giving women the message that they are strong, powerful, beautiful human beings, and that they can do this, sometimes needing our help, which is fine. But we start out with, you can do this. So that's, you know, part of the influence that I felt from the home birth movement, as well as from what was called the natural childbirth movement. And it's interesting because the book I'm working on now, my daughter in Seattle had two home births, and I was very interested in the midwifery practice and the home birth movement in Seattle, which is totally different than in Massachusetts, because there is a midwifery school. Midwives are trained, they're certified, and they're fabulous. They're educated, knowledgeable women. And the thing is that they're not against science and modern medicine, but they think it has a place. And I do agree with that philosophy that sometimes you really need it, but you don't always need it. Every woman does not need an episiotomy, does not need an IV, does not need an epidural. You know, this can be done with the true power of women, which is what we have. So it's a blend.
You've seen so much change, and you've been part of creating so much change in this field since the 70s when you got started in it. You're just a bit older than I am, so I've seen a lot of this happen in my life too. But fortunately, the first birth that I had a part in was my son's, and that was in 1986, so things were well advanced at that point. What Ina May Gaskin, her book, Spiritual Midwifery, it gets these other elements that our medical system didn't include, that I think you brought out sensitivity. You're paying attention actually to the woman as opposed to a science manual or something. I don't know how to describe what it really was. Could you give me a good comparison of how it was then and how it is now? Like, for instance, do home births happen in the U.S.? How much back then and now? Mind you, I lived for 2 years in Togo in West Africa, where almost all births are home births, right? And when Ina May Gaskin talks about what they did at the farm, they had a backup doctor in town who could go to, but it was maybe 2%. Actually, it was even less, but then they invited women from all over to come who wanted to do natural childbirth. And she said it went from, you know, like 1.5%. Cesarean sections was very low, and it got up to 2% because they allowed all kinds of women with problem or places where they wouldn't let them have natural birth elsewhere. What have you seen in your life in practice?
First of all, I have to say that I haven't done obstetrics since I had a severe disc rupture in 2005. So I haven't been on the wards or on the floors seeing what the current practice of obstetrics is. But what I do know is that there's a very high epidural rate, which means that birth is inherently medicalized if women are having epidural. So epidural is a kind of regional block that when it was first introduced in when I was practicing was very what we call dense. So women would get an injection right adjacent to their spine, and then their whole lower body would go numb. And, you know, if you've been having severe pain every 3 minutes for 24 hours, it's really a relief. But the problem is that they were so dense that women couldn't push. And that kind of epidural had an impact on the course of labor. But what's happened since then is that epidurals have gotten better, and they've figured out how to block some of the pain, but be light enough so that women can still push their babies up. I don't know how it's working right now because I just haven't been in hospitals. Although the impact of the women's movement and women's empowerment and natural childbirth is felt even if it's a medicalized birth. So for instance, you know, when I was born 76 years ago, babies were separated from their mothers immediately after birth because they thought there was some risk of infection. This I don't understand this because baby came through the mother's vagina. Well, you know, I just don't understand what they were thinking. But this totally screwed up breastfeeding, whereas now there's an understanding the baby should be put to breast immediately after birth. And if they can suckle, they should do that. And that this establishes skin to skin and bonding. And, you know, there's all sorts of good things that happen from very early exposure to breastfeeding. That is part of women demanding to have more control over their bodies. So I think that there's a false distinction between saying it's a medicalized birth and nothing good happens. Some good things still can happen, but The medicalization of birth, I think, is the problem. On the other hand, we have cultural changes. You know, when the quote natural childbirth quote movement, I put it in quotes because childbirth is natural, so I'm very ambivalent about that term. But when that came in, you know, the women who chose to do it were very motivated. They were seizing control over their bodies. They had major issues with their doctors. They wanted to have choice. They wanted to be able to say how they had their babies. And that was a stream in women's health and in feminism. And there's a whole tendency now for many women to not feel that way and to feel like, pain? Forget it. I want my epidural as soon as possible. So the question is, how does that impact the birth experience? You know, the C-section rate in the hospitals has gone up. You know, some hospitals are 40% C-section rate. So is that because of all the medicalization? That probably has a contribution. Is that because breech babies, you know, babies that are coming out butt first, are now almost routinely delivered by C-section for good and bad reasons, but that's where it's at? And is that because we're able to save premature babies much more aggressively nowadays, and many, many survive and do well, and many of them are born by C-section? You know, there are all these things that come together that create a very high C-section rate. You know, I think that medicalization is part of the problem. The other thing you need to remember is that women who have their babies at home are usually healthy women. And so if you take out all the high-risk pregnancies and only deliver low-risk women, if you do it right, you're going to have a low C-section rate. That's how it works. But I do think that a lot of folks feel that the C-section rate is much too high. And there are women, I mean, I had patients who said, I don't want a labor, I want a C-section. And I was like, oh goodness, how do I deal with this? You know, because a C-section is a major surgery and it's not without risk. And even though it's very safe, you know, we were designed to have babies. And I think embracing our bodies in their full power and their full amazing capacity is part of being a woman, but only if you feel like you can do that. So I don't want to say that a woman who doesn't do that is a failure. She's being herself. And I think everybody has to figure out where they stand on all of this.
Folks, we're talking to Alice Rothschild today. Her recent book is Inspired and Outraged, just came out this past month, The Making of a Feminist Physician. And she's joining us from Seattle, although her work was really mostly in the eastern side of the United States before she moved out to be a wonderful grandmother and so on.
And write books.
And write books. One of the amazing things about the book, again, is that it's written in poetry form. I wonder if there are two strong sides to your personality, because I think that your notes that you have to write for all your patients and all of this kind of thing, there's a very logical, straightforward, here's the form, and poetry is a totally different thing, and you write it beautifully. I get so much information. One of the things I think is true of poetry is you can get more information with fewer words from a poem than from a well-written doctoral thesis, whatever. It's different. So why did you choose poetry for the format?
So I'm, you know, an untrained writer. I mean, I've now written 6 published books, which means I'm really a writer. But I was playing with doing a memoir, and I wanted to focus on, you know, growing up in the 50s and 60s, the politicalization of my generation, how that impacted medicine, what medicine was like, what it was like to try to live by some feminist principles as an obstetrician gynecologist and a mother and a wife and a partner and all those kinds of things. And I had written a little bit in prose, and it just didn't have the punch that I wanted it to have. And then I started getting phrases, poetic phrases in my brain that would like literally wake me up from sleep, or I would be hiking and I'd have to stop and write it down, or I'd be biking, or, you know, in some place where my brain was not thinking much, all of these memories would come back and all of these phrases would come back. So I just started writing them down. And I realized that the memoir was coming to me in poetry. And once I got over the shock of that and embraced it, it was really fun because, first of all, I didn't write it in chronological order. I just wrote whatever came to my subconscious consciousness, there it was. And then I would write it down, and then I would sometimes do more research or review letters or old documents or old textbooks or whatever was coming up. And then I would work on it and work on it and work on it until it was something, you know, worth reading. So it was how it came to me. And the thing that's fun, as you mentioned about poetry, is that I could be outraged. I could be sarcastic. I could be funny. I could be playful. I could do all of those things. And I could say very heavy things that are just evoked by a line or two. And I loved that technique. I love to be able to do that. And I think it makes it much more readable and much more accessible for someone picking up the book. So they don't have to wade through a chapter that's like talking about the politics of the time. I can just kind of sprinkle it in with some reminiscences, some phrases, and you've got it, you know. And it's also very sensory poetry. You use all your five senses to share what you're trying to bring up. Because I want this to not be an intellectual exercise. I want people to be hit emotionally with what I'm saying and my transitions and my transformation. So that's kind of what happened. But then I had to sort it all through and put it in some order. And it was like, oh, this has to like be readable. So that was a whole nother work. And I was very lucky. I have a critique group that meets every week. And so I got to read all of this poetry to my critique group. I also sent out particular poems to people I thought of as stakeholders or people who I thought might have an opinion about this that I should know about. So I did a lot of that kind of back and forth as well.
There's nearly 400 pages of it, which is a rich amount. People may not just jump at this right away. Again, the title is Inspired and Outraged: The Making of a Feminist Physician. This book is certainly dealing with your work as a physician, but it's also dealing with your life growing up as a Jew or living in inner city and dealing with the inner city clinic that you founded. It's about big cultural changes in our nation. So there's history and there's personal. It's quite rich in the scope it covers in the 400 pages of the book. Had you intended to take on that big of a job when you wrote this book?
I had no idea. I'm a very intuitive writer. I had no idea how many pages it would be. What I did know I wanted to do is place my life in a political context because I am a political person. I do believe that there are political forces that make the world the way it is and that make people the way they are. So it was very important for me that people not only know that, you know, I went to college in 1970, but that there was a war going on and that there were student protests and that there was Kent State and there was all, you know, I wanted people to know the times because I think people are products of their times. And particularly in our current time, where I think we are taking a huge step backwards, I think it's very important to look at history and to understand the victories and the mistakes of history. And so I want to contribute to that particular conversation as well.
Well, there's so much of it. People, again, will read it in poetic form. I found it very digestible to grab a couple pages at a time and digest it that way. There's any number of issues that I'd like to talk to you about, and some of them specifically about your medical. So, well, I guess, yes, you mentioned something right away. Back in the day in Massachusetts, you said that home birth was illegal. And I somehow imagine for the Amish that didn't apply because of a religious exemption or something like that. In the 1980s, I had a visit from a Quaker from the Netherlands who was a midwife. And she said there, I think a third of births were home births in the 1980s. So that's quite a bit different. So when did this happen in the United States that it went from, of course you have your baby at home unless there's some problem, and then you get the doctor to come, and to this thing where it's all institutionalized?
So back in the 1700s, 1800s, you know, women had their babies at home, and that's where they had them. And midwives were the usual person to deliver the baby or to assist the woman in delivering the baby. And the midwives, some of them were very skilled. They were all taught by their grandmothers or some other woman that did midwifery. And what happened was that in the 1700s and 1800s, doctors went to train in Europe. And as you can imagine, medicine in either place was pretty devoid of science. You know, they didn't know about bacteria, for instance. So the main thing that doctors did was to deliver babies because that was the main thing that happened. You know, people died of infection and they also died of being bloodlet and having, you know, all sorts of toxins poured into their bodies and the kind of crazy things that were being done. So what happened was that the doctors came back to the States feeling they had been trained in medicine, although it was devoid of science. And they perceived the midwives as their economic competitors. So there's a history of decades of doctors literally pushing out midwives because they didn't want them to compete and taking over obstetrics as their purview. So the mythology before that was that women take care of women. That's what women did. And then it became women are too emotional and too, you know, they get their periods and God knows what they're going to do. They can't be trusted to do this very complicated thing. So birth became defined as a dangerous process rather than a natural process. And then you needed the expert white male Christian man to assist in this dangerous process. At the same time, hospitals were being built. And unfortunately, the hospitals were basically places that poor people went. And doctors began to realize, oh, they could train on these poor people, which is another big trend in medicine. But doctors hadn't figured out yet that you have to wash your hands after you see a patient and touch her and put your hands in her vagina. And so there was a whole decades of doctors, you know, examining a woman in labor and then going to the pathology lab and putting their hands in strep infections and all sorts of horrific things. And then without washing their hands, going back to the next patient. So there was what's called puerperal sepsis, which is infections around the pregnancy that killed hundreds of thousands of women and babies. And the irony was that everybody thought this was like the higher level of healthcare because these were doctors. So the mythology about doctor expertise preceded their competency. So midwives were portrayed as, you know, first of all, female, which already means that you don't have the intelligence and capacity to do this, but also as dirty and dangerous. And so they got run out. So that trend continued and continues to be one of the themes in obstetrics in a lot of places. So it took, you know, the discovery of germs and the discovery of washing your hands and the discovery of sterile instruments and all that kind of stuff, as well as things like public health. So, you know, living in crowded conditions in poverty with poor nutrition creates worse outcomes in pregnancy. You know, you get to take a shower and you get to, you know, treat your strep infection and you get to wash your hands in a clean sink. And already your health is going to be better and your babies are going to be healthier. All these different things happened. And then they invented blood banks, which saved a lot of women who were bleeding to death. So there were different strains that led to the idea that doctors are the safer ones. But there's a long history of doctors not being the safer ones. So for instance, the idea of delivering babies by forceps deliveries. They used to do high forceps deliveries, mid forceps deliveries, and these were tremendously dangerous to the babies as well as to the mothers. And it took a lot of data and research to convince doctors that that was not a good idea. And you know, the doctor that I was my chief, Emmanuel Friedman, was one of the people who did this research and said, you will not be able to do high and mid forceps deliveries in my hospital. And that was like a big fight. And that's in my lifetime. So, you know, we see all these trends coming together to create the idea that the doctors are the smart, safe male people to take care of this very dangerous process. And midwives are basically thrown out the window. And the irony is, for instance, if you look at the data on women taken care of by midwives, as well as women who have doulas, you know, someone just being with them in labor in as a supportive person, their outcomes are better. They have lower C-section rates. They have less episiotomies. You know, it's interesting that there's now a sort of beginning more understanding that birth is a normal process if you don't screw around with it. And, you know, we see all these different dynamics going on, and it's all part of the political scene. How are women portrayed? What do women feel about themselves? How powerful do they feel themselves? Are they always an inadequate species compared to men? You know, all these things are going on, and it all comes out in obstetrics.
There is so much history and experience and reality checks that are in Alice Rothschild's book, Inspired and Outraged, Making of a Feminist Physician. She is our guest here today for Spirit in Action. Our website is northernspiritradio.org. Her site is alethrothschild.com and alethrothschildbooks.com for her children's books. You'll be able to follow those links from northernspiritradio.org.
I would just like to add, the Rothschild does not have an S in it.
Right.
You know, my grandparents lost the S at Ellis Island when it got, quote, Americanized. So it's Rothschild.
Yes. And the correct spelling, and if not the pronunciation, is on northernspiritradio.org. So you'll follow my links to her and all of my guests through the last 19 and a half years, both for Spirit in Action and for Song of the Soul. Please come to our site, post comments, track down our guests, and give us your feedback because we love two-way communication. We love hearing from you. I can't emphasize this enough. We love connecting with you both in terms of the direction you can send us. Who are the world healers that you know that we should be connecting with? There's also a place to donate. This work is financed by listener donations, not by government and not by corporations. And that's key in terms of influencing what we can and will be expected to go. I follow my muse as directed to me by my listeners. So please support us. It makes all the difference. Otherwise, we'd have to depend on corporations. They want to influence things. I'm sure that's something that you experienced in your work. There was the point where you created the inner city clinic of your own leading. You get to do it your way, at least to some degree. The government's still influencing you. How do you feel about that mix of the fact that hospitals used to be almost all nonprofit and now that there are for-profit? I mean, that change is so influential in terms of what you can and can't do and how you do it.
You know, I do believe that healthcare is a human right and that women's reproductive care is part of women's healthcare and thus a human right. So we would do better and we would be healthier and we would have healthier babies if we all had good access to healthcare, as well as, you know, good nutrition and all the other things that make us healthy. So I am not so afraid of government interference. I'm afraid of the interference of profit-making industries. So for instance, the drug companies that produce some very, very important pharmaceuticals are basically in the business of making money, which means that, first of all, they only research things that they think they can make money for. So, you know, when I was in training, there was almost no understanding of things that women experience every month of the year: premenstrual syndrome, menstrual cramps, perimenopause, menopause. I mean, these were common things, but they weren't, quote, sexy enough for drug companies to do much research on. And the way they research it is not, you know, what kind of diet and exercise will help you get through this? It's what pill can I give you that's going to cost a lot of money that then you're going to have to come back and buy every month. So the pharmaceutical industry, which is a very, very, very big, powerful industry, skews how we see medicine and what options we have to offer our patients. So I think that that's like a very critical example. I mean, when I was in med school, the pharmaceutical companies kind of swarmed around. They gave us free doctor bags, free stethoscopes. And just to give you a flavor, my class took our free stethoscopes and sent them to a group in North Vietnam in solidarity with the Vietnamese and wrote a letter of thanks that got published in our local newspaper. This did not go over very well with the authorities, but, you know, the drug companies wanted us to see them as their buddies. They gave us free dinners before a lecture, you know, just cozying up. And I think that that's a very dangerous kind of relationship. And the same is true with all sorts of profit-making things related to medicine. And so the idea that profit-making hospitals move in and take over a huge swath of the hospitals in the city, which happens all over the place, is very dangerous because profit-making companies need to make a profit. Your health is somewhere down the line. I think that's part of why, even though in the United States, we spend much, 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 much more money per patient than any other advanced, quote, end quote, country in the world, we have poor outcomes. And we have poor outcomes because our healthcare system is not geared towards health. It's geared towards profit. And that is a huge, huge problem and something that we constantly have to be agitating for and pushing our Congress, which is fairly hopeless, to make the steps in the right direction.
There are so many changes that have happened in the course of your life. I'm trying to remember exactly what year it was that antibiotics were discovered and started being shared regularly.
In the 40s. So I had scarlet fever as a baby, and penicillin had recently been invented. So, you know, I'm here because there was penicillin, and I'm very happy about that. But that was the 40s.
Yeah, well, there's that, the whole women's movement and this change. I recall, you know, I basically in the 1950s, women were supposed to be, and oftentimes forced by employers and sometimes by law, they had to be at home. They couldn't have an option of working. So your entrance into the medical field, in particular obstetrics, gynecology, this happened in the 1970s. Things were really rudimentary at that time. It's amazing.
Right.
Certainly the changes in the 60s set the stage for some changes like this. But wow, what was the percentage of female physicians or gynecologists or any of that when you got in versus when you stopped practicing?
There were about maybe 10 or 12 women in my class. When I entered my obstetrics and gynecology residency, there were two women 2 years ahead of me, two women my year, and that was the total for the history of the world at this Harvard hospital. I would love to read a poem about what it was like when I graduated from college, because it does have a lot of that kind of stuff. So in this poem, I talk about all the things I did before graduation, and the US had just invaded Cambodia, and there's all the stuff going on. And then I write, I had finally gotten into medical school. All you need is one, waitlisted at two. I stood on the grassy rolling hills, neatly clipped lawns, stately gray stone buildings, surrounded by a roiling river of smart, accomplished, privileged women. A swarm of bees leaving the nest, the world a deeply uncertain, unwelcoming place. The facts. In 1970, which is the year I graduated, banks could require a woman applying for credit have her husband co-sign. In 1970, employers could legally fire a woman for being pregnant. In 1970, conjugal rights meant that it was legal for a man to rape his wife. U.S. laws included housing discrimination, pay discrimination, jury exclusion for women. A husband had unilateral control of property jointly owned. A woman had half the legal rights of a man, earned 59 cents to the dollar. Help wanted ads in newspapers listed jobs separately from men, just about everything, for women, secretarial, nursing, teaching in 1970. The swarm buzzed and swooped on the cusp of a new world, the frenetic winged flight blossom to blossom, sucking up nectar, breaking it down, the constant fanning of wings, evaporating liquid, creating a sweet golden liqueur to nurture the young, constructing a life of hard work, stinging when provoked. My class, a murder of crows, swooping out of a pine tree to dive bomb a predator, an avalanche of rock tumbling down a mountain, making a new path, a sisterhood forged in protest, outrage, ambition. 25 years later, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
I remember an ad I saw in speech communications class, 1972, where the Communist Party candidate, it was a video of him. He says, people say we shouldn't be stepping on corporations' toes. I say we should be stepping on their necks. It was a motif of the day. Yeah, so many changes that have happened. Your title of the book, Inspired and Outraged, again by Alice Rothschild, The Making of a Feminist Physician. Inspired and outraged are two ends of feelings, but sometimes they go together. How outraged as you are now versus then? I mean, there's so much to be outraged about that people weren't even, when you grow up in a setting, you don't realize that you should be outraged about it. So there's a whole amount of learning and stepping outside and looking at it from better advantage that has to happen. Has your outrage increased or decreased?
Well, I think it's ebbed and flowed. When I was in medical school, there were so many things that were so outrageous, like we're studying microbiology. And it was the time when they had the slides up on a screen. And every few slides, there was a semi-naked Playboy bunny, which everybody thought was cute. And I was like, this is like disrespectful to women. It's the wrong message, blah, blah, blah. And we went to the dean and he was like, can't you take a joke? And I was like, no, we cannot take a joke. This is not funny. So there was that kind of outrage. So I came to my feminism very honestly through personal experience. And then, you know, when I was more in control of my own practice, I was having babies, I was working a million hours a week. You know, I didn't have time to be outraged. I was trying to survive the experience of having it all. But there was so much to be outraged about. A lot of it was around health inequities, struggles in the hospital. Like, we worked with midwives, and it took 8 years for the hospital to give our midwives, these were not lay midwives, these were certified nurse midwives, delivery privileges, which meant that every delivery they did, one of us had to run in and stand behind the curtain while they did a perfectly lovely birth. And then we had to sign the birth certificate. So it was this kind of like microaggression after microaggression after macroaggression that went on for years and years and years. I'm currently more outraged, I think, because I think what's been happening over the last decade is a real backlash against the fact that women actually made some gains in this society and that people of color actually are now in positions of power and are recognized more often than not as human beings, and that LGBTQI folks are coming out of the closet and demanding their rights and, you know, being in positions of power and being more respected. I mean, all of these kinds of things. And so people who are threatened by that largely white men, but there are other people who are threatened as well, are really pushing back. And they're pushing back in a really big, well-funded way, which is incredibly, incredibly dangerous, not only for the health of all of those folks that I mentioned, but for everybody, because I am a believer in a liberatory politics that is a liberation for everybody. So I'm not in the if I win, you lose, because I think if I win, you win, that there is room and space for everyone in this kind of liberation, but we have to approach each other respectfully, with dignity, with civility, and understand each other's traumas and wounds, but also address them. And I think it is possible to do that. And right now, the sort of tone in this country and in the world, because there's so many right-wing dictator fascistic types people coming into power, is that winning is all about squashing everybody else. And I think that we're in for really tough times. I mean, just look at the issue of abortion and reproductive choice. Reproductive choice is a core element in women's healthcare. It is a human right to have reproductive choice. And this is under such threat that, you know, I just worry for my children and my grandchildren. I can't even imagine what kind of world we're going to be living in. And I was on the front lines of fighting to get reproductive choice. So it's a real sense of despair as well as outrage that I'm kind of living in right now. And I think I'll have a more figured out way to deal with this as months go by and I get over my horror and shock.
Are you going to be part of the march in January? The marches across the country, I think.
Yeah, if there's something local, I will. I have, you know, childcare to do and all sorts of obligations. So it's not, yeah, it's so funny because, you know, I thought, well, when I'm, quote, retired from clinical medicine, I could just go anywhere anytime. But I mean, I happen to have established a life that has a lot of the kids arrive at noon and you better get the Play-Doh out. And, you know, I have to be part of a family that I'm now embracing that I love dearly. But it means that my activism is mostly more local. But I'd be happy to be marching in the streets, I'll tell you. And I'm marching with my children and my grandchildren. I mean, my granddaughter has been to more marches than you can imagine and has her little buttons and all that.
Back in 2017, during inauguration for Donald Trump, my wife went over to the Twin Cities where our son and daughter-in-law live and our grandchildren, two granddaughters there. And so they went to the march and her six-year-old, I think at that time, maybe even five-year-old granddaughter at that time, she made her own sign. It said, "Donald Trump, be good."
Right, very age appropriate.
And it's wonderful to have the multiple generations involved in this. What kind of experience have you had internationally related to birthing? I mentioned the friend I have who is in the Netherlands. When I was in Togo, like I said, everything was basically home births. There was another Peace Corps volunteer, a friend of mine, who came as a kind of a medical clinic appointee or something. She was going around helping all these little villages, and that morphed into becoming essentially a midwife. She, at the time I talked to her last, she had participated in 115 births, which is a lot for anyone, and this was in less than 2 years that she had been there. So there's a very different look at what pregnancy and birth is like in Togo versus the Netherlands versus maybe the U.S. What's your experience internationally?
So I haven't been to the Netherlands, but I've studied a lot of the methods and styles of birthing and pregnancy care, particularly in Europe and in Scandinavia, because I think that a number of those systems have something that we could emulate, which is that low-risk women are taken care of by midwives, either at home or in birthing centers or in a hospital, depending on the woman's choice. And that if she needs more assistance, then she risks into higher levels of care as she needs it. And I think that that's a very smart, sensible kind of approach. I've also done a lot of work in Israel-Palestine, and so I'm very aware of the issues of what is called reproductive justice. And just to give you a flavor for that, you know, in Israel, there is a very first world, high-level healthcare system, and the health outcomes are very good. And in the occupied territories in the West Bank, and now particularly in Gaza, the health outcomes are really terrible and getting worse. And so what we know is that things like a strict occupation, a brutal siege, horrific war has a direct impact on reproductive justice, has a direct impact on the outcomes of pregnancy for women and pregnancy choices. So in a wartime situation, women do not have access to contraception, to prenatal care, to birth attendants when they're giving birth, to high level care if they need, you know, a transfusion or a C-section, that this is all related. So I'm also very involved and aware of the whole movement for reproductive justice in Palestine. So that's sort of where most of my international work has been done.
Your recent article, The Nakba Continues, and for listeners who don't know that the Nakba is the whole devastation, it's really Holocaust for the Palestinians when they were driven out of their homes, a lot of them into refugee camps, etc. It's great suffering. So you're addressing certain aspects of this in your article, The Nakba Continues. What is the essence of that article?
So the essence of that article is that the war in 1948 between Israel and what were called the Arabs, but were basically the Palestinians plus several Arab countries that leaned into this, was directed at seizing as much land as possible and driving Palestinians out of their indigenous lands. And as you mentioned, many Palestinians ended up living in refugee camps or fleeing to other countries. And that is part of the foundational history of Israel. And I can tell you, as a kid who went to many, many years of Hebrew school, we did not learn that history. Our history was, you know, the Jews suffered from the Holocaust. They needed a safe place. Israel was a land without a people without a land. They were welcome there, and everybody lived happily ever after, except for these horrible Arabs that kept attacking them. That kind of distorted history ignores the reality that there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living in historic Palestine. They had cities, they had towns, they had a vibrant agricultural system, they had universities, they were Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and that this all got blown up by the 1948 war. And it continued with the 1967 war when the Israeli army captured the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. So what the article is arguing is that the 1948 war started this process of dispossession and killing and driving Palestinians off the land, and that it continues to today. And I think it is incredibly, incredibly painful to see what's going on in Gaza now. Many people are talking about this as a continuation of the Nakba, of driving Palestinians out, of destroying them, of destroying their houses, their universities, their health centers, their hospitals, and causing them to flee. And it is all part of the general task of what is called Zionism, which is a political movement to establish, quote, a homeland for Jews in historic Palestine without Arabs in it, without Palestinians in it. So the argument is that this is continuing and that all the wars that we have seen since 1948 are not aberrations, are not something that's inexplicable, are part of that process. And it also allows us to understand that Palestinian resistance, whether you like it or not, whether you like the form it takes or not, is to be expected because oppressed people resist their oppression. That's part of human history. And if we want oppressed people to stop resisting their oppression, you have to stop oppressing them. And if we talk about the level of violence from the Israeli military and the Israeli government is far outweighs the level of violence of Palestinian resistance, which has mostly been nonviolent. But that's not even mentioned when people talk about the history of Israel-Palestine.
A month or two ago, I was part of the regular monthly Third Friday peace stand we have here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. A couple months, Palestinians stopped by and were so thankful that we were speaking out against the damage being done to them. My opposition is to all war. But then the following month, right at the end of it, two Israeli women who were living in Eau Claire, they had served in the IDF and so on. So I had this conversation with them. They were only in their 20s, maybe 30s. And, oh, they were so mad at me. How can you possibly call it this? And you know, just all these kinds of things. And they had every defense. I wish they could have listened to you, who said it so well. Just last week for Spirit in Action, I had a Quaker friend who lives in Philadelphia, but who's from New York City originally, talking about her conversion to anti-Zionism. You, Aleph Rothschild, born and raised as Jew in the eastern part of the United States.
Yeah, small town.
Yeah. Do you get attacked for being anti-Semitic because you're criticizing the state of Israel?
You know, I did grow up in a very traditionally Zionist family. We loved Israel. I went to the country when I was 14. I have a diary and I talked about the dirty Arabs. I mean, I grew up in a liberal progressive family that was very racist towards Arabs, but we didn't see it. So my change in attitude happened over the years by becoming a more politically aware person and then studying the conflict and beginning to listen to Palestinians and understand sort of a history that I had not been taught. So anyone in this country who criticizes the policies of the state of Israel or speaks out suggesting that Palestinians have a narrative that we should pay attention to and that we should support them will be attacked as an anti-Semite, as a self-hating Jew, if you're Jewish. Otherwise, you're just a regular old anti-Semite, and all sorts of horrific things. And that's part of the territory of being in dissent from this mythology that is part of the propaganda that we all grew up with. It's just part of the landscape. And I think what we see is that there are very powerful political forces, not only organizations like AIPAC, which is a Jewish lobbying organization that I always call it the Jewish NRA in terms of power and political influence, but also from the Christian evangelical Zionists, who are a much larger group in this country and who are very eager for, quote, all Jews to go back to their homeland, end quote, so that we can have the coming of Christ and the apocalypse and all those kinds of things that are going to happen, which would result in the death of all the Jews who don't convert. So it just doesn't seem like a great plan to me. So they are advocating driving the Palestinians out and taking as much of the region for Jews as possible. And I think it's a completely destructive, racist, terrible idea. You know, we're in dangerous times, and the forces that are critical of people advocating for justice for everyone, because it's not like Israeli Jews live in Israel. They should live in Israel. That's where they are. 20% of Israelis are Palestinian. They should also live in Israel. The rest of the Palestinians, an equal number of Palestinians equal to Jews, lives in the West Bank and Gaza. They should all live there. But the point is, how do they do it? And as long as Israel is the occupying, dominating force, and as long as the Israeli military reserves the right to kill, blow up houses, destroy schools, do all the things that they do on a regular basis, this is not going to happen. So the problem is that this is all happening with US military and political support. I mean, the US has given many, many, many billions of dollars of weaponry to kill basically Palestinian women and children. Somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the people who've been killed in Gaza are women and children, who are by definition innocent. And I should also add that a lot of the men who are killed are also innocent. So we're living in an upside-down time, but the forces that are protesting this and that are challenging US policy are growing. And I think we should be paying attention to that and marching in the streets and signing the petitions and doing all the things you have to do to make this a powerful force.
Thank you so much for those words, Alice. You know, if we had enough time, I would talk to you about your inner city clinic, that whole wonderful and challenging experience. I would talk about the hazing that doctors go through during residency in particular. I would talk to you about living in commune, the various experiences you had with respect to racism and other kinds of discrimination, in addition to those about women. I would ask you some more about your experience being Jewish and how that's transitioned. And we'd go on and on for quite a while, but you have grandchildren who need your attention, so I'm going to release you to them. Is there anything you'd care to finish with?
Well, I think those are all the reasons to read the book.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yes. Read the book. It's 400 pages, folks. It's easy read in pieces. And again, the name is Inspired and Outraged: The Making of a Feminist Physician by Alice Rothschild.
What I would like to say is that this is not only my personal story and the historical context in which my personal story occurred, but it's also a call to action. I want people to like be inspired when they read this book and to think, you know, I have a place in history and this is a political moment. How can I move justice forward? How can I make this a fairer world and a better world? And I think, you know, we all have to do our little teeny weeny part, and it's really easy to be totally discouraged, particularly as we approach the reign of the Orange One. But we can't do that because people are suffering. We will suffer, our children will suffer, and so we need to be active and engaged in our communities.
Exactly. Again, all those things that Alice just said are in the book, are there and many more, and they're in a very palatable and moving format. So please do read Inspired and Outraged. Again, her website, alicerothchild.com, alicerothchildbooks.com is the other place where you find her children's books. They're on northernspiritradio.org. Thanks so much for taking time away from your grandchildren to be with me, Alice.
Well, thank you, Mark. This has been a pleasure.
And folks, please follow the links from NordenspiritRadio.org, and we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on NordenspiritRadio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.